This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. This week, more on our role in protecting water, part two of our search for a water ethic.
You know, I think it boils down to doing the right thing for your family, for the future, and for your neighbors. And those neighbors include all living things.
Jane Elder is with the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters.
For me, that's the simplest way I can look at the ethic, that no drop of water belongs to any of us. There's a finite amount of water on Earth. That's the way it's been since the planet's been around. We don't get to get any more of it. So the water that we do have is the water that we take care of. And if we do that, everyone's always going to have what they need and it will be clean. We're not there now. So we have some work to do, but I think it's realizing it's not ours, it's everybody's forever. And if we can take care of it, everyone benefits. If we don't, most of us don't benefit and can get hurt in some pretty serious ways.
Some 100 participants in the 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held earlier this year in La Crosse spent 2 days exchanging stories, ideas, and at times some rather critical thinking about a water ethic, principles that guide how we as individuals, communities, businesses, and governmental agencies address issues related to water. Jane Elder set the stage for those conversations. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Academy of Science, Arts, and Letters, co-sponsor of the conference that was hosted by the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics in Leadership at Viterbo University. Hers were among several perspectives we shared in our previous edition of Newsmakers, questions and suggestions regarding how those of us surrounded by free-flowing rivers, pristine trout streams, and generous supplies of groundwater should be thinking about the future of the water we often take for granted. As mentioned last week, one of the things growing out of the conference is a fairly comprehensive web-based collection of materials that delve into the issues of water ethics in greater detail. Hosted by the Institute for Ethics and Leadership, the conference site will be expanded this next month to include presentation materials from the conference, a new video documentary, and archives of our conversations. More on the site at the end of this program. Our dialogue continues this week with two additional conference presenters and their thoughts on water scarcity and security, values that underlie the way we use, share, and care for water, the impacts of climate change, economic globalization, and a general realization that we're just one part in a much larger global life cycle of water. At the table with me are Christiana Papard, an assistant professor of theology, science, and ethics at Fordham University. Among other things, Christiana is author of Just Water, Theology, Ethics, and the Global Water Crisis. She's joined here by Jeremy Schmidt, a Banting Fellow in the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University. He's also associated with the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. The challenge you presented to those attending the conference, Jeremy, was to recognize and then forget our water theories and narratives that have been guiding us for years. So what do we do with that?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good question. I think one of the places to start is that we didn't get into these problems from nowhere. And so it's important to think about how we got into these particular problems. And one way to do that is to think, well, why do we have these problems and not other ones? Why do we face these water challenges and not some other water challenge? And I think once we start to ask that question, then we start to think more carefully about the terms on which we understand debates about water and about what we want to do going forward. Because what we don't want to do is keep repeating the same mistakes over and over again. And so what I've tried to do is to spell out very clearly the assumptions that are kind of buried from view, and then to expose those. Hopefully they kind of dry out and we can put them in the compost and maybe use them for something else down the road as a lesson learned, right? But to not repeat ourselves over and over with the same mistakes.
Because really what you've charged is that, in the U.S. anyway, that we're following flawed models for how we plan or even think about water management, which is really at the root of so much of our concerns right now.
Yeah, and I mean, typically when we talk about water management, we're talking about how we make decisions. Mm-hmm. Right? And to make decisions, we draw on values, we draw on data, we draw on the procedures through which we come to agreements or settle disagreements. And all of these things are part of the conversation, whether it's at the municipal or state level. And so that's sort of one of the challenges that we're faced with, is if we know the ways that we've been coordinating our decisions have led to inequality, have led to pollution, then what are some alternatives and what are some new ways in which we can achieve fairness, you know, set standards that are minimal guarantees for equality? These sorts of parameters and criteria are really important in stepping away from the current models that we have in water management.
You've suggested that we've come out of a history of looking at imagining that there was an abundance of water, and then that there was a scarcity of water, but neither of those were right. Yes? No?
Well, this is one of the interesting things, is that the way that we've understood water's abundance has been a cultural understanding of abundance for whom? And it's been abundance for the development of things like big hydro projects, big urban water systems. And that's had an imagination of one vision of American society behind it, right? That has often worked at the expense of indigenous people in North America, right? So abundance and scarcity are cultural ideas, but they're cultural ideas that do real work when it comes to managing water, right? And so the notion that we can create a lot of abundance behind big dams was something that we actually did, mm-hmm. right? Now, of course, after we've done this all around the world and affected the climate, we're finding out that, well, you can't really bend a complex system like the Earth into the straight boxes of dams and reservoirs. It doesn't really work. And so we find out that those ideas did work, and they did work now that we realize is undermining our own prospects while it's still being unequal for others.
And how is it that we've landed at security as being what you also would say is still not the right way of looking at it or feeling secure in water?
Right. So one, the issue of security comes up at two levels. One, it comes up with the notion that if we have really intense water scarcity, we might end up in conflicts between states, or even just big drawn-out legal battles between states, like, for instance, the states in America, right? But countries could also, for instance, have deep conflicts over water. So that's one notion in which security comes up. Another one is about having enough water for healthy ecosystems, for human development, for health, for sanitation, you know, for the sorts of things we're concerned about now with pharmaceuticals in the water or with pollution of groundwater through new ways of extracting hydrocarbons from the earth. So these understandings of security are the ones that we're faced with now, right? And one of the reasons that we should think more carefully about security is we have to think security for whom and for what, right? What do we want these waters to do? And who do we want them to be secure for and in what form? What kinds of ecosystems do we want, right? What kinds do we have? These are the reasons to sort of revisit these and to not make security an objective standard, right? It is one way of thinking about water, and there are others, right? So it should be positioned as such.
Christiana, you've obviously done some studies, some research, and some writings on this topic of security, and I see you want to jump in here, so please do. Yeah,
great. Well, I actually wanted to link to the security scarcity aspect, but then circle back to some of the more conceptual terrain that Jeremy was covering. I think on the contemporary point of interest for a lot of listeners in the U.S. might be twofold. On the one hand, this narrative about water scarcity and water security, and as Jeremy rightly pointed out, on the level of states and potential interstate conflict, but also on the level of is there enough for basic needs and for what we want to be able to use it for. But then this question of scarcity, I think it's worth digging into what people mean when they say that. And you know, a lot of folks in California right now, in various other parts of the nation and worldwide, experience water shortages and water scarcity in a range of ways. Some of those are deeply climatological in nature, or, you know, specific to geography and hydrology and the particularities of a place and its climate. Others of those are mediated by human institutions and frameworks of governance and large construction projects like building large dams. And I think that's a really powerful aspect that Jeremy's work nicely brings out, which is that the ways in which water governance and water management have come down through the 20th century, really, in the U.S. especially, are not neutral. They have value systems behind them. They have motivating factors. They conduce to certain kinds of outcomes instead of others. And it's worth interrogating whether those are outcomes as well as premises that we actually want. Are they just? Are they fair? Are they good in the long term for people, for ecosystems, for other things that we might think have value? And some of the work that Jeremy's done on normal water, making it so normal as to be invisible, these big kinds of projects and constructions of how humans in the U.S. relate to water and towards what ends. Given that we're talking about water ethics, I think a nice way to summarize this might be that in the U.S., we certainly have a water ethos, and it's part of the work of scholars and historians and geographers and ethicists to excavate that and to make it legible for those who are interested in learning about the past, so that when we start talking about how we want our water-mediated relationships to look now and in the future, we can be very intentional and inclusive as to constructing a water ethic.
One of the things that you write about a lot and that you've shared in your conversations at the conference has been the role of memory of water. Talk a little bit about that. Introduce that to our listeners.
Sure. Well, memory is a big category, and water arguably even a bigger one, and then you throw ethics into that mix, and it's just a huge morass. So I actually have been really intrigued for a long time by people's particular stories pertaining to water, partly because I have some of my own, having grown up in a very arid place, and wondering as a kid, for example, why we had irrigated lawns when there were perennially summer droughts. I was born in Fresno, California, and then moved when I was in elementary school to the suburbs of Denver. So certainly west of the 100th meridian, where rainfall is less than 20 inches a year. What I started to notice, certainly through those experiences of growing up, is that different cultures and people and communities relate to their water sources in different ways, and that sometimes this has to do with the covenant-controlled restrictions on subdivisions, and sometimes it has to do with more explicitly religious or cultural forms of knowledge and practice. But as I started delving more deeply into the topic of water and the histories of water negotiations and management and control of rivers around the world, I began to meet people who had various kinds of stories in which they had experienced dramatic forms of change on a river, in particular rivers, though it doesn't need to be limited to rivers, wherein a river that had been full and flowing and hardy and dangerous, really, in their childhoods now looks more like a sometimes desiccated, sometimes polluted, but nonetheless somehow disempowered flow. So my question was, and still is, I mean, this is ongoing, and I think it's a real question for societies to take on, is what happens when our conceptualizations of a river, whether in individual memory or in collective memory, differ profoundly from a reality of a river that is polluted, whose flow is degraded? Is that something to be mourned? Is it an ethical problem? There's a lot of ways into it, and I don't necessarily think there is one answer, but I think it's an important site for reflecting on what we understand rivers and water to be.
Christiana Papard is a professor at Fordham University, working in the area of American studies and environmental policy. Jeremy Schmidt is with the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University and a member of the Ethics and Environmental Group at the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. They're both presenters at the 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held at Viterbo University in April.
In this area, of course, the Mississippi is key. It determines so many things up and down the river. It's as a source of drinking water, as a source of the fisheries. It's transportation. It's all kinds of things. But it isn't today what many of us remember it being, 10, 20, 50 years ago, as you're saying. This is the case rivers around the world, really. While it's important to remember that, you also caution that while memory can help shape our vision of what a river should be, we shouldn't be too nostalgic about it.
Well, I do tend to have a little bit of healthy skepticism towards nostalgia. I mean, look, you know, there are certainly places in the world where I have been and have a strong emotional, spiritual, physical kind of memory of. And honestly, if presented with an opportunity to go back to some of those peaks at sunrise or those night skies unpolluted by light, would I go back? You know, is there a fear that perhaps... Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the experience could be replicated, and would that in itself be a sense of loss? Okay, so that's one kind of caution. But this problem of nostalgia is real, and I think we see it in terms of social and political discourse a lot, that things were better back in the day for one reason or another. And while to some degree that's true with environmental realities, especially various forms of water diversion and degradation, it's also the case that socially and in terms of various forms of equity, things haven't always been great. And so how do we take the potencies of our ecological memories, our social memories, and then mobilize those into visions of flourishing and equity?
Well, and maybe not set ourselves up with an expectation that we're going to fail at?
Yeah, absolutely. So the tendency towards idealism that, well, I mean, there's just so much to say here, but one idea is that, you know, we don't want to set ourselves up for an ideal that is unattainable and therefore in its unattainability leads to despair. That's one problem. Another problem, though, is that as ecologists know and students of biology, systems are not in stasis. Things are always on the move. Change is a datum. So what do we do with the fact that things are always changing? And how do we evaluate what's natural, quote unquote, and what's healthy or good versus what's unacceptable or bad? I think those are some of the questions that need to be brought into the realm of conversations about water ethics. And surprisingly, I think that memory does have a role to play in that.
An example that's close to home, I guess, that I think about, and I don't know that either one of you can comment on it necessarily, but the generation of people who used to be able to remember the Mississippi River before the locks and dams, those people are passing on, and most of them have passed on, so there's not much, if any, memory of what that was like. And yet, as things like needing to replace some of the locks and dams come up for conversation, the questions arise, you know, is it possible to maybe not go there because of what it was like? Mm-hmm. But that seems to be setting us up for thinking about things that perhaps just aren't possible just because of the world, the way it is, and economics and business, industry, transportation, where people are living.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. When we come to the question of when technical hydraulic kinds of infrastructures need to be replaced, it's an opportunity to reflect on how they got there, why they're there, and what good they're serving, and whether a different kind of relationship to that body of water can be envisioned, or whether, say, not fixing the lock, et cetera, would actually imperil communities in an unacceptable way. Totally valid questions to consider. I think that a go-to example for me in this is that after this era of construction of dams, both large and small, across much of the U.S. In the mid-20th century, starting in about the 1980s and increasing through the present day, there's been a lot of energy behind dam demolition. You know, whether it's on behalf of salmon and their runs or on behalf of just the idea of, why did we have this dam in the first place? So that's an interesting example to consider. It's not identically translatable to the Mississippi context.
The Mississippi is so massive.
Yeah, and it's its own thing. As T.S. Eliot says, it's a strong brown god.
It is, and there's not a lot of arguing with what it has become over the last 70, 80 years of having the locks and dams. And yet there are tributaries to the Mississippi that do have perhaps only one dam on it that might be worth looking at and seeing what the possibilities are.
Can I say one more thing about memory? you know, there's a danger of being all doom and gloom about the question of environmental degradations and, oh my goodness, all the pollutants and this is devastating and we've diverted all the rivers and we're just a desiccated, impoverished society. You know, it can really be very self-flagellating. What I think is important to remember as well is that there are memories within the lifespan of people today of rivers that caught a flame and of places that have been so polluted that one couldn't swim in them. Now those places have been restored, a kind of ecological health is returning to them, and those are other kinds of memories that can be mobilized towards empowerment. They're also highly place-based. So there isn't necessarily one-size-fits-all kinds of solutions. And that awareness of what it is to dwell in a place with the particular problems and the particular opportunities facing those bodies of water and those social relationships is really important.
And again, I'll use the Mississippi as an example. There was a time not too many decades ago where you would not have gone swimming in the Mississippi. Now we do. Seasonally anyway, depending on, you know, what's flowing and what the what is either in the water because of runoff after the spring melts and what have you, or flood stages and all those kinds of things, you know. Jeremy, Christiana mentioned your references to normal water. And part of your address was really to talk about the narrative of normal water. Is there such a thing as normal water? I mean,
one easy way to understand it is to say, well, at some point, water became a resource. And for a long time, water was seen as the sort of uncontrollable threat. And it was a really great accomplishment in the minds of many to subdue the capriciousness of water, to bring it into service, to harness it for the benefit of the public. And the processes by which that happened and by which water became a resource, which in America was declared in 1909 in one specific publication. And that those ideas then that we worked with afterwards, right? Those are what I mean. How when we talk about water as a resource, which is now commonplace, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about a specific relationship of water and us to it. And my use of the term normal is simply to draw out the fact that when we talk about water, we often crisscross over lots of different things at once. We talk about the social standards that we use for water, like turning off the tap when you brush your teeth or not washing your car too often. But then all of a sudden, we might get into something quite technical about why our sewers, our stormwater systems mix in with our sewers during floods. Well, that's also another issue. And then sometimes we get into more health-based things about environmental health, our own personal bodily health. And finally, we might get into things about the planet itself and about how climate change is affecting the intensity of storms or the number of hurricanes or these sorts of things. Well, this social, technical, geological, or health senses are all different dictionary definitions of normal. So really, I just went to the dictionary and looked up the word normal, and I saw it had four senses, and I thought this is a handy way to try to organize this very complex crisscrossing set of things that water does, because it goes in and out of our lives so frequently with our food, with our, you know, discussions with, you know, with all sorts of things. I thought, well, we need to have a conversation that can help us think about these really, really complex interconnections without getting lost. And so I thought, why don't we try to map out how we came to have this shared understanding of water. And then I just called it normal water because it seemed very convenient.
So the counter to that would be abnormal water. I mean, does that exist? Where does that fit in?
I mean, I think water is weird. I mean, in many ways, we don't understand it. I mean, there's still lots of debates in the philosophy of science about whether water is H2O or not. This is still a standard philosophical question. There's still lots of things that we don't understand about what water does in the subterranean depths of the earth. Hydrologists only a few years ago have decided that one of the key tenets of modern hydrology, which is the idea of stationarity, an idea that the hydrological cycle might vary from year to year, but it's stable over time. So it's a stationary set of parameters it operates within. Hydrologists have now rejected that idea because climate change has pushed the whole Earth's system into such a state that the extremes on either end have shifted. So here's a way now in which water is quite weird again, right? A key tenet of hydrology is now gone, and we have to find a new way to understand what's going on. And there are lots of examples like this. Maybe I can give just one more. When we started to become very concerned about climate change, one of the first predictions was that storms would become more intense because an increased temperature in the atmosphere would allow more water vapor to be carried, and hence there would be stronger rain events. Well, for a long time, that didn't happen. And it wasn't clear exactly why that didn't happen. But then all of a sudden, the extreme rain events did occur. Well, why was there that discrepancy? One of the reasons is that it turned out that the aerosols that we had polluted the upper atmosphere with before the 1980 Ozone Convention with the Montreal Protocol were actually counteracting the rain events. And once we put in the policies that stopped the aerosol pollution, there's a certain time delay. Well, once those aerosols started falling out of the atmosphere, the heavy rain events we expected started to come. Right? So there's these very complicated set of interactions, and we make some decisions at one time with not really understanding what the effects might be sometime down the road. And so one of the weird things about water is that we find ourselves not as objective observers of the planet by any stretch, but as creating the conditions in which we're trying to understand, and trying to understand how our own actions and how our collective choices are influencing the conditions in which we live.
Part of what Jeremy's work in terms of water ethics, and then also more generally, draws out are some of the benefits and vagaries of thinking in planetary ways, and the modes of thought, the histories of thought that have pressed us to embrace those or facilitated the embrace of those. And a couple of things I want to flag. Planetary thinking is really important in many ways. It helps to position, I think, people's and society's self-understanding in different ways. You know, a lot of people point to the 1968 photo of the Earth as a blue orb from space. So there's a kind of perspectival shifting that is really valuable. But one of the dangers is that in thinking of planetary trends like climate and how water and water vapor intersect in those ways, there's a danger of universalizing and assuming that those planetary or universal trends are also uniform. And a significant chunk of my work, I'm coming to realize, is about how to articulate with integrity what about planetary changes we understand through science or philosophy and a range of other disciplines, but what ought not to be generalized, and what becomes problematic when it is generalized and applied blindly to contexts that are in their own right very diverse, whether in terms of ecology or in terms of social environments. And this, I think, frankly, if I may be so grandiose in my statements, is one of the guiding philosophical challenges of the 21st century, is to parse these relationships between desires for universal planetary thinking and the particularities of place and how human conduct and ways of knowing fit into that.
Christiana Papard and Jeremy Schmidt, they're presenters at this year's Conference on Water Ethics, hosted by the D.B. Reinhardt Institute in Leadership at Viterbo University. Our discussion on a water ethic continues when Newsmakers continues right here on Wisconsin Public Radio from La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find a link to the Water Ethics Conference page, where you'll find additional materials about the presenters, not just a who's who introduction to those who spoke at the conference, but a gradually expanding virtual center for conference handouts, videos of selected presentations, audio interviews with several participants, and a newly produced documentary featuring conference presenters. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm John Gatto. We're considering the need for and possible sources of a water ethic during this edition of Newsmakers, the second of two programs exploring the topic with presenters at the 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held earlier this year in La Crosse. Our guests this hour are Jeremy Schmidt, a Banting Fellow in the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University. He's also associated with the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. And Christiana Papard, an Assistant Professor of Theology, Science, and Ethics at Fordham University and author of Just Water, Theology, Ethics, and the Global Water Crisis. Earlier, you mentioned T.S. Eliot, and you identified the Mississippi River as being one of those strong, brown, godlike bodies of water. And you talk about what it is to know a river.
Well, I don't have the final answer on that. What is it to know a river? Well, there are famous, of course, adages, you can't step twice into the same river. I think a lot of what I was trying to convey, perhaps it was subtly, perhaps it was hitting people over the head, is the idea that it is difficult to know the waters of a place in the abstract or in a two-dimensional rendering on a map. These are different forms of knowledge. You know, writing a narrative about a river or a history of settlement on a river is fine and good and important and a form of knowledge. Cartographies and the courses of rivers and latitudes and longitudes, those are also really vital pieces of information and ways of knowing. But a lot of what many aesthetically oriented ecological thinkers draw out in their work is the importance of a connection to the place where one is or where one is from. So in my talk at the Water Ethics Conference, I began with Aldo Leopold. And on the one hand, his work in the Coon Valley watershed here in Wisconsin as an example of place-based knowledge and work, and contrasted that in a certain sense to his 1948 recollections in a Sand County almanac of his 1922 trip to the Colorado River Delta with his brother, a place that he did not know well. He certainly didn't own in any sense of the term, nor inhabit. But nonetheless, he tried to observe as best he could. And I would say more broadly that some of the patterns and lyricism of Leopold's naturalism are what keep drawing readers back into him. You know, he has a deep appreciation of place, even if it's not a place he's long lived. And part of what I find when I go back to read, especially Sonora and Chihuahua in the Sand County Almanac, is a sense of epistemic humility. And I get that from Leopold in a lot of different writings, but when he writes in Song of the Gavilan that in order to hear the song of a river, or even more so of the hills or the mountains that surround it, you have to have lived there for a long time. You have to be attuned. You have to pay attention. And the kind of knowledge that attention conveys is different from the kind of knowledge that a map or the chemical formula H2O conveys. All these things have to be part of our knowing of water if we're going to know a river.
But it's not just getting to know a river. It's getting to know your lakes, your ponds, your aquifers, your watersheds. There's a lot of talk, increasingly so, about watersheds in order to be mindful of management practices for any particular river or its tributaries. That kind of intentionality and focus is what's necessary as we think in terms of developing a local water ethic. It's pretty much in agreement, everybody at the conference saying that there can be a water ethic, but really a water ethic is what's going to be, you know, close to home. Christiana, you say that water ethics based on patterns of relationships. And Jeremy, you've said that we need to rethink how we frame our realities in thinking towards water ethics and how we're moving forward. Christiana, you say the religious, cultural, individual, collective power of memory is all important parts of shaping an ethic. I'd like both of you to address this question of how do we shape that ethic? How do we do that locally as well as in the context of a a larger society?
Well, this is a really great question. I think one of the first places to start with is that we're not going to get a single water ethic. The first thing I think we should note is that to share a watershed is to share our different experiences with the water, the different consequences of living with a resource that when I use it, it flows to the next person. And this shared situation, the shared fact of life, I think is the basis for starting to develop a water ethic. Because everybody has a different position, a different perspective, a different set of values. And I don't think that that we should discard any of them out of hand. And so I think we should start with an honest appraisal of how we all live together right now, because already things aren't fair for some people and they work to the advantage of others. So one of the first things to do is to identify those and to start addressing the inequalities in the ways that we currently use water. And I think that requires listening to the people and to the communities who are on the weak side of the power relationship. And there is sometimes a tendency to want to just represent what we think the problems of other people are. And I think the first step is listening. And so I think that's the first place, is we live with neighbors, right? We live with school teachers. We take our loved ones to hospitals. All of these places need water, right? We need clean surgical tools for the doctors. But of course, hospitals make messes because they have to do things that are very difficult to do. But, you know, the starting point here, I guess what I'm going for, is to identify that we often have a deep care for others, and that caring for water can be a part of that care for others and cultivating that. So I think this is one of the first places in terms of thinking locally about the fact that, you know, I'm sharing things with whomever it is, right? And as, you know, as someone who travels to lots of different places, this is something that I think of often is, you know, now I'm here sharing somebody else's water, right? And then I'll leave. So I don't want to leave things worse off, right, than when I got here. So that's one starting point.
And awareness, people being aware of that, is part of it. But what you've just listed and identified is an intentional way of thinking about where water plays a role in our everyday lives. That in itself creates its own awareness that then we can think about and ask others about or respond to or respect and pay attention to. Christiana.
I echo what Jeremy said wholeheartedly. I would add as a second moment that there are questions of individual action and consumption that eventually turn into questions of scale. So what do I mean by that? You know, many people are really interested in water issues, and that's fantastic. It gives me great hope. And there are lots of things we can think about, from what types of fertilizers we do or don't use on gardens or larger scale farms, and where those go when they run off in terms of after their application and after, say, a rainstorm or irrigation. There are different kinds of choices we can make about the agents that help our plants to grow. There are choices we can make about the kinds of foods we eat and where they come from, all those sorts of things that have to do with domestic kinds of consumption and impact on water supply. There are also some questions that need collective socio-political attention, and many of those are in the realm of bigger picture agricultural trends on the one hand and energy sources on the other, because there are strong linkages between consumptive uses of water in agriculture in some regions, especially in the U.S., and then on the other hand also variously consumptive and non-consumptive uses of water for energy extraction and fossil fuel extraction. And particularly in this part of the world, where the Keystone XL pipeline has been a major topic, the depletion of natural landforms for frac sands has been a major issue. All of these things are interwoven, and those are questions that individuals can grapple with in a range of ways, but that also require bigger collective will to address.
We're talking with Christiana Papard, a professor at Fordham University, working in the area of American studies and environmental policy, and Jeremy Schmidt with the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University, and a member of the Ethics and Environmental Group at the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. On this edition of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm John Gatto. They were among the presenters at this year's 2015 Conference on Water Ethics held at Viterbo University in April. I wanted to give each of you an opportunity, in as much as you sat through not just 2 days of conference discussions, but you've sat through each other's presentations as well. And we should say that you have collectively worked together on writing, doing different written reports and whatnot, and publications and what have you. What would you ask the other?
Oh, wow, fun. Jeremy, you run a blog that goes by the name The Anthropocene. You range across disciplines and are critical in some ways of how hydrology and geology have emerged in the 20th century with a strong U.S.-dominated narrative behind them. And you're, I sense, often critical of the notion of the Anthropocene. What are your thoughts on, and do you have any hopes for, forms of global ethics or Anthropocene ethics?
Sure, okay, that's a really interesting question. So the Anthropocene is a way of understanding geological eras. So there's things like the Holocene, the Pleistocene, the scene where dinosaurs lived, all of these sorts of geological records. And the Anthropocene is one that's designed to designate the impact of humans on the planet. So that's the context. So for me, one of the reasons that I think we need to think carefully about this is that it's a certain subset of humans that have led to forms of consumption and to forms of interaction with the natural world that have given rise to things like climate change. Not everybody is equally responsible for producing these things, and And certainly not everybody has reaped the benefits and or shared the harms. So often the harms accumulate doubly. People don't get the benefits and they receive the harms. So one of the reasons that I'm skeptical of this idea or concerned about it is that I don't wish that any sort of geological framing of the Earth should look like something that just naturally happened. Right? This was something that is the result of political choices, of different historical ways of things like colonization, of massive sugar plantations, of the ways that we produce our energy and our food, our vehicles, our computers, all of these sorts of things. So my concern is that we might lose some of these really deep ethical and political questions through a geological category. Now, my response to can we have a global ethic is that I think that is unlikely, right? I think that we have many other things to do besides speculate about how everybody should try to share the planet in one form, because I think we have an immense amount of cultural diversity, and the last thing we want to do is create projects that are ethical or political that would try to collapse all of that diversity into one single voice. I think we're much stronger with numerous voices, and I think we're much better off if rather than trying to conform a whole bunch of different perspectives to our ways of thinking, if we learn to practice and live in different ways. And I think that is one of the key lessons of humility, to pick up on a theme that you brought out, that we need to learn, is that there are other ways of living and that there are lessons that we need to take on board, we being the people who have benefited. So I put myself in that group. So that's a cursory answer to your fair but difficult question. So now let me return the favor. Because you are a professor of theology and of science, I would be very interested to hear a little bit, as someone who lives in the smaller cousin to the north in Canada, about how the current sort of excitement about the Pope and the sort of broad and strong feelings about religion in America affect what you think are real prospects for doing, making improvements around water?
That's a great and hard question, Jeremy. The religious studies side of me and the theology side of the title of my professorial position refers to an expertise in Catholic social teaching and the evolution of concern for the environment within official Catholic magisterial quarters since about 1967. So, what does Pope Francis have to say about this is the question. I mean, so several ways of answering, and particularly I think you're interested in the nexus between the fervor over this present pope and what we might call the entrenched or recidivistic tendencies of much of U.S. Congress in terms of scientific questions. Okay. This is such an open question. I am so excited to see what happens because we have several converging forces. On the one hand, we have a very vocal group in U.S. politics that also tends to have a very strong base among religious Christian folks, often fundamentalist and evangelical, some of whom have a real apathy historically and in the present towards scientific questions and can be very angry at Darwin and what I see as Darwin's, you know, great-grandchild, which is climate change. So there's this social, theological, political, scientific wrangling that's always going on. Sometimes it's subterranean and sometimes it's really explicit. As we've seen in the U.S., there's a lot of political back and forth about whether we can talk about climate change and whether it's happening. And then that's even before you get to the question of whether the U.S. has any responsibility to do anything about it. So that brings us to the Pope. It's really interesting to me that so many people in the U.S. are keen on this Pope because he's saying things that I have seen in Catholic social teaching for some time about duties to the poor, duties to the environment, especially insofar as it affects people living in poverty, questions about the responsibility of quote-unquote super-developed nations towards other less fortunate groups, whether or not you go with territorial sovereignty. And he's come out with a formal, authoritative set of teachings on the environment, on ecology, so forms of relationships among environmental entities and humans. I don't know that the Pope addressing Congress is going to change the minds of people who have significant lobbying interests filling their back pockets. But here's what the Pope visiting can do. Number one, put forward a more global perspective and a moral voice on how economics and global interactions are ethical issues. They're not merely questions of efficiency or public policy, but they redound to questions of how we humans relate to one another and the environment. Second, as a head of state and a religious figure in a very authoritarian church structure, he's in a very unusual situation. I mean, there's basically no one like him. Third, huge Twitter following, and people across all kinds of aisles seem to really like him. So will what he says resonate with many Americans? Maybe. And fourth, this is the Pope who has a master's degree in chemistry. So he is not someone who is ideologically resistant to the idea of scientific facts or ways of understanding and charting the world. He's very receptive to them, and the Pontifical Academy of Sciences has had many, many conferences and consultations on things like climate change. In fact, Paul Crutzen, who's one of the Nobel laureates who came up with the idea of the Anthropocene and proposed it as a geological period, he himself is a member of the Pontifical Academy for Sciences. My greatest hope, I think, out of all of this would be, on the one hand, that the Pope gives some deeply religiously committed people an example of a way forward to hybridize religious belief and scientific understanding towards the integrity of relationships. And secondly, maybe Congress would be shamed into doing something better.
Christiana Papard and Jeremy Schmidt. They were presenters at this year's Conference on Water Ethics hosted by the D.B. Reinhardt Institute in Leadership at Viterbo University. Papard is Assistant Professor of Theology, Science, and Ethics at Fordham University and, among other things, author of Just Water: Theology, Ethics, and the Global Water Crisis. And Jeremy Schmidt is a fellow with the Department of Sociology and Social Anthropology at Dalhousie University. He's a member of the advisory board of the Water Ethics Network and recently joined the Ethics and Environmental Group at the Center for Research in Ethics at the University of Montreal. If you missed part of today's conversation, you can find archives of our show at wpr.org/newsmakers. You'll also find links to the first of this two-part Newsmakers series exploring water ethics, as well as extended interviews with several of our guests. Plus, you'll find links to the Water Ethics Conference and additional background on the presenters. And this next month, that site will be expanded and relaunched with conference handouts, videos of selected presentations, links to other water ethics resources, and a newly produced documentary featuring conference presenters. You can find all of that and more on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. And that wraps up this edition of Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm John Gatto. Many thanks to Viterbo's Institute for Ethics and Leadership in helping facilitate these conversations, and to our senior news editor and producer, John Davis, for creating and managing our Newsmakers website materials and links.